Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is so mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. And my guest today is Zach Mangan, who is the co-founder of Kero, the Japanese tea importer and distributor based in New York and Fukuoka, Japan. He is also the author of the fantastic book about Japanese tea, Stories of Japanese Tea, The Regions, The Growers, and The Craft. And in September 2021, he opened a beautiful tea shop and gallery in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, which is now one of the coolest sections of New York. And Zach joined us in episodes 44 and 264 and talked about his fascinating and somewhat accidental path to becoming a tea expert and his love and passion for tea. And Japanese tea is gaining the attention of consumers and beverage professionals nowadays for its pure deliciousness and diverse flavors, as well as its healthfulness. So today we'll discuss various flavors of Japanese tea that you can choose from, how to select the right type of tea to your liking, sustainable sourcing of Japanese tea that you should keep in mind, innovative Japanese tea products that are gaining attention among tea connoisseurs, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Zach Mangan. Hello, Zach. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Akiko. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, so for listeners who have not listened to episodes 44, 264, where are you from? And how did you end up devoting your life to Japanese tea?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story. I am originally grew up in Pennsylvania, went to school up in Boston, and then moved to New York City, actually, to play music. I was a professional jazz musician for some of the years of my younger life. And when I moved here, I was already kind of interested in Japanese tea. It was something that I discovered in college and something that I, kind of fell in love with, but just sort of something I enjoyed at home. But when I moved to New York, I needed work. So I actually started working for a Japanese tea store in Manhattan because, you know, in addition to looking for work with music, I needed something else to support myself. And I actually didn't expect that that would lead to a career. But, you know, as I, you know, started working there and continued to work there, I became, you know, deeply fascinated with Japanese tea and with ceramics and Japanese culture. And little did I know, after about 2 years, the store closed. I was able to start traveling to Japan. I visited Japan for the first time in 2010 on my own. And it was that trip that really sparked my, you know, idea for starting a business. So I took some time over the next 3 years, actually, to just, you know, casually start to build relationships with farmers and kind of understand, how the tea industry in Japan worked. Because, you know, prior to that, I was just living here in New York and you know, selling tea leaves, but I didn't really know that much about the industry. And it was during that time that I realized, you know, there were many kind of pain points that restricted farmers or tea producers from getting their tea into the United States. And through kind of the, you know, those years of listening and just hearing, you know, how, what some of those tricky points were, it kind of led me to rethink the idea of, you know, what an importer does. So I actually ended up setting up an office in Fukuoka Prefecture with some partners and started building these relationships, as I mentioned. And then, you know, it was really after about 2.5, almost 3 years that I was finally able to kind of, you know, develop a strong enough relationship and enough trust with the grower that they would allow me to sort of take their teas and bring them into the United States. And that's really the beginning of how the company started and how we still work today. I still have an office there. I still work with a lot of the same producers. It's grown a lot now, of course, but the sort of simple passion to connect these wonderful farmers and producers with, you know, with customers here and abroad, that remains the same.
Right. So that your quick version of your how you got into this whole thing, this is really the most interesting part of packed in episode 44 and also 264. It's really like you can write a book about it, how all those coincidences led to your office opening in Fukuoka, not anywhere else. So listeners, if you haven't, episode 44, that's really amazing. Yeah, and then, you know, like you said, growers, your book contains a lot of interesting stories about growers, which I love because tea, Japanese tea, is very artisanal and human-made, and you need the backstory, and you really appreciate, like, you know, like if you go to Burgundy Winery and who's making the wine, it's the same idea of it's a handmade, precious, traditional product. So, yeah, your book really depicts it, and also your website features a lot of great farmers, too. So, anyway, so there are many types of tea in the world, including British-style black tea and a wide variety of Chinese tea like Oolong and Pu'er. So could you tell us what is so unique about Japanese tea compared to other types of tea?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Japanese tea really, up until probably 30 years ago, was tea developed for the domestic market, meaning that most tea in Japan was consumed in Japan. And because of that, the style of tea, you know, that's consumed most often or was consumed most often in Japan is green tea. That means that by category, Japanese tea is 99% green tea. And within those categories of, you know, within green tea, the larger category, there's many different styles. But what kind of makes it unique across the board is that the tea leaves are steamed after they're picked. Where if you compare that to a country of origin like Taiwan or China or India, they're using a different method of heat to, you know, to fix the leaf right after they pick it. So that's something unique. But I think beyond what, you know, just the style of tea and the, you know, method in which they make it, Japan has an incredibly unique tea culture. So historically, it's developed something that I think touches on almost every point of Japanese culture and society that developed out of the tea ceremony. So that's something very, very unique. It's kind of intertwined with the, you know, many points of culture, whether it's food, you know, history, religion. Tea is kind of this thread that runs through Japanese culture in a way that it makes it very distinct and very unique, in the same way that, you know, tea had traveled out of China and ended up in many countries. And whether it's, you know, as I said, Taiwan or Korea or Russia, tea really reflects the culture and place that it goes. So obviously Japan has such a unique and rich culture. So it really reflects it in a very special way.
Right. Yeah. You just touched on that, you know, spiritual side of Japanese culture that's influenced by tea. That's interesting. Like the Sen no Rikyu, who established this idea of tea, subject of focus instead of something with decorative. And it's very, became a tool, focus. I think it's probably related to some caffeine effects or something. But yeah, that's a whole other episode. We can do that, you know, the spiritual side of tea.
Yeah, you know, to your point too. Yeah, I mean, the, you know, if you think about Japanese cuisine as well, I mean, if you're familiar, if your listeners are familiar with kaiseki cuisine, which is really the sort of highest expression of Japanese seasonal cooking, that was born in the tea room. I mean, that is a cuisine that was developed right literally in tandem with traditional Japanese tea ceremony. And a lot of, you know, sort of the service style, the etiquette that you use, even, you know, beyond food into just, you know, the way society interacts, people interact with each other in Japan, you can really see the seeds of that in the tea room. And, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, Sen no Rikyu was one of the sort of most influential characters in that. So if your listeners are interested to learn more, I highly recommend. There's a great movie about Sen no Rikyu, and there's a few books you can find as well. He was a fascinating person.
Right. And there are so many words of wisdom by Sen no Rikyu, and the way he died, even. He was trying to stay kind of clean and focused, and he didn't change his philosophy of tea as the tool of spiritual clarity. And the shogun, who's against his idea, told him to kill himself, and which he did. So, yeah, that's like a very heroic story. But, yeah, maybe we can just do another episode about spiritual side of Japanese tea. So within the category of Japanese tea, there are many different types as well. So for listeners who are not familiar with Japanese tea, what are the main types of Japanese tea?
Right. So as mentioned, 99% of tea produced in Japan is green tea. And the major kind of categories of green tea would be sencha, which is the largest category of all tea produced in Japan. It's a steamed green tea, and it can really vary in its profile and its taste depending on which prefecture it comes from. Then we have gyokuro, which is a very unique, very high quality shaded green tea. We have matcha, which many people are familiar with, which is a milled green tea that's whisked rather than being brewed. We have hojicha, roasted green tea. We have genmaicha, which is a blend of green tea leaves with roasted brown rice. And then actually beyond green tea, there are other unique varieties of tea, including black tea, oolong, some pan-fired green teas, and even fermented teas. If you travel to the island of Shikoku, there's a really interesting tradition of making fermented teas there. So while most people are probably familiar with a few of those teas, there's actually quite a deep landscape of tea being produced throughout Japan.
Right. So tea is very regional too. And like you said earlier, you know, Japanese tea is steamed instead of roasted. So the color is brighter. Mm-hmm. It's like a fresh, greener vegetable, but sweet and yet slightly bitter, but then umami rich. So it's like there's a triangle of flavor in one cup.
You're describing it perfectly. It's a complex flavor, that's for sure. But to your point, steaming, again, is that really unique characteristic that brings out this really, you know, gorgeous, deep color, this natural sweetness, and also umami. You get this kind of unique savory characteristic with Japanese teas that it's just so beautiful to have alongside Japanese cuisine. The integration of flavor is just like they were born for each other.
Right. And also another difference is, Japanese tea are not fermented. Like, you know, you said there are exceptions, like you mentioned in Shikoku or some other places. But, you know, like oolong is half fermented, black tea is fully fermented, and all those different nuances. And Japanese tea, because there's no fermentation process, is something very distinctive experience. So, yeah, that's something. Mm-hmm. It's not just the matcha powder. It's the actual loose leaf tea can offer so much. Right, and also because of the process, Japanese tea is known for its healthfulness, and it's not just like, you know, it's healthy looking or healthy. There are some clinical proven health benefits. So what are the health benefits that's proven in terms of Japanese tea?
That's a very, very good question. I'm glad you asked that. I actually take a chapter in my book to discuss the health benefits of Japanese tea, and I was really honored to be joined by Dr. Andrew Weil, who was a very influential person in my getting into Japanese tea. He's someone who promoted it a lot in his books. And I always really enjoyed his take on it, because like anything that's naturally healthy, marketers will take hold of that and start to distort maybe magnify certain things or not tell the whole story in order to sell more product. But my philosophy and what we do, at my company Kettle is we really want to focus on making sure that we're direct and very truthful about the health benefits. And like you said, Japanese tea is full of really unique health benefits, unique chemical structures. I think that the number one thing that you're looking at is that the consumption of Japanese green tea does have, or clinically is shown to have, a anti-inflammatory effect on the body, and most likely that's through the presence of a certain type of antioxidant called catechin. Catechin is unique because it's actually the same chemical that protects the tea plant, and I'll explain how. So when a tea plant is growing in full sunlight, it's absorbing large amounts of sunlight to photosynthesize and create energy. And when it does that, it also is susceptible to UV damage, the same way that if you go out without sunscreen on, you can get a sunburn. So tea plants actually produce higher levels of this certain chemical catechin to, repair any cellular damage that they get from sunlight. And when tea is manufactured and it's processed in the way that they do, which is it's very lightly processed, it's steamed, it's rolled, it's dried, those steps actually help to, maintain the level of catechin in the leaf. So when you, the end user, consume that leaf and you drink that tea, those same catechins, which were protecting the plant from UV and other types of free radical damage, you consume those same chemicals go into your body and do the same for you, which is, I just love that idea that you're sort of inheriting the, the health protecting benefits that the plant was using. So I just think that's such a unique and kind of magical story to think about how that ends up in your body. But yeah, those catechins, they've been shown to, again, we try and stick to peer reviewed or, things that have been shown to have a high likelihood of truthfulness through lab studies. But yeah, I mean, showing lower rates of cancer, blood pressure, looking at cholesterol, I think it's safe to say adding Japanese tea to your diet is a smart move. And it's something that will over time enhance your health and well-being. And one of the other things, Akiko, which doesn't get talked about that much, is sort of the mental and spiritual side of taking time out of your day to do something thoughtful and slowing down. I think that also promotes kind of a sense of well-being as well. So I would say on the other side, just be wary. I mean, anytime someone sells a product, they're going to, sometimes make some less than truthful promises in the hopes that you'll buy it. So if you see things from, companies promising very, very specific things, like you'll definitely lose weight or your hair will grow back or, whatever it may be, the chances are, take that with a definite grain of salt. But I can say unequivocally that consuming high quality Japanese tea is something that absolutely will impact your health in a positive way.
Right. And also, also the L-theanine that is present more in green tea, Japanese green tea, which I heard along with caffeine is calming, but also that really increases your focus when you do certain tasks. And
that's so true. Yeah. Yeah. L-theanine sort of works almost like a counter balance to caffeine. So if you have, when you drink caffeine, your nervous system sort of wakes up, you kick into gear, you feel this sort of like pleasant feeling of energy. But over time, you may start to feel a little bit a little bit strung out or, a little shaky, where L-theanine actually sort of balances that feeling of energy with this sort of calm, restful, sort of focused energy. And those together, I think, work in really nice tandem to help you not only, get energy, but also stay focused.
Right. So it's kind of anecdotal, but shoguns and, monks drink green tea to focus. And at the same time, you're awake, but you're kind of calm. So That's what I heard. But it is not proven. I never measured all those blood data of those shoguns and monks. But I think it's pretty effective. And also, I like coffee. And I feel like I had too much coffee and I feel jittery. And I have some, you know, L-theanine. And it goes away. So L-theanine is built in green tea. So that's why I don't get that jitter very often, or almost never with green tea. So that's a, it's a good benefit, I think.
For sure, yes.
Right. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into how to select the right Japanese tea to your liking. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kikotema. My guest today is Zach Mangan, who is the co-founder of Kettle, the Japanese tea importer and distributor based in New York and Fukuoka, Japan. He's also the author of the fantastic book about Japanese tea, Stories of Japanese Tea, The Regions, The Growers, and The Craft. And in September 2021, he opened a beautiful tea shop and gallery in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. So there are more quality-oriented tea shops, including yours, Kettle Tea, in New York, as well as online shops that ship worldwide because Japanese tea is gaining attention globally. So what is your suggestion for where to buy high-quality tea besides your shop Kettle? And how can you tell the vendor is a good one?
Great question. Something we talk about often. I was doing a training just a couple of days ago, and I talked a lot about this exact question. So, you know, for us, the future of tea is very much sort of in line with the future, or, you know, what you see with wine and with spirits, where there's a lot of information, there's a lot of diversity in the vendors, and a lot of specific retailers who can kind of guide you. And in tea, we're still definitely in the infancy, meaning that even the tea sellers, you know, obviously here in New York City, we're lucky we have, you know, plenty of specialty tea shops. But I think, you know, in most places, a lot of times even the tea purveyors are not, you know, don't have access to all the information. So it can be challenging if you're a consumer looking for, you know, very specific information. So what we like to say is, you know, build a relationship, just like if you have a local wine shop, you know, build a relationship with someone you trust and learn from them, you know, ask questions, ask for recommendations. So, you know, you can start to learn from people who know more than you. But I do think one of the things that I always say is you should use your own taste to guide you. So no matter what, if somebody says like, this is the best tea, you should like this, you should try this, and you don't like it, it doesn't mean you're missing something necessarily. It just might mean that you have a different profile that you're, you know, interested in, or your taste is different than what someone might be selecting. So I would definitely tell people when they're learning to be open, to try as many versions or varieties of certain style of tea as possible to find, you know, what it is that you like. But a few things that I think you should look for when shopping for tea is, you know, how specific the retailer can be about the, you know, the origin of the product. So, you know, if you're looking for, let's say matcha, I talk a lot about this with customers who are looking to buy quality matcha, and they say, oh, I buy it on Amazon and I never like it. It doesn't taste good. Well, the truth is, you know, a lot of that, you know, if you buy that matcha and you look at it, there's actually not that much information. So you want to find out, of course, the country of origin. When you're dealing with Japanese teas, obviously you're looking for Japan. If you're buying sencha from a different country, you know, it's really hard to call that sencha because it may not be produced in line with the quality parameters that are set in Japan. So you want to know, of course, the country of origin. More specifically, if they can tell you a prefecture or a town within a prefecture, you're in really good shape. I mean, the more specific, you know, the information, the better, you know, I think the product and the more you can trust that retailer. And, you know, if they can even give you the name of the producer, to me, that's like the dream. That's like wine. So, you know, for me, the most value is when you can actually connect the product to a person. And for me, that's something at our company, we really strive to try and share as much information about as possible, is who made it, how it was made, where it came from, what are their regional characteristics. But at a minimum, you definitely want, you know, the country of origin, you want to know when it was harvested. So an important thing to note is that with Japanese tea, it's not something that, you know, is typically aged for long periods of time. So, you know, when you have puer or certain oolongs that are, you know, continually roasted, you may see like this is a vintage from 1988. You don't see that as much. You do a little bit with certain teas, but not so much with Japanese tea. So you're really looking to try and consume teas within the calendar year of when they're produced. So that means teas are harvested in the spring, so April, May. So for example, we are now coming up on the end of the teas calendar year. So all the teas, the freshest teas, were produced in the spring and they, you know, last for that year. And then we get to harvest in April for 2023. And that's when the new harvest starts coming in. So you want to ask them, when was it produced? And they should be able to tell you that. And then expiration date is really important. So you don't, you know, these teas aren't like, you know, once they're packaged, there is a shelf life. And we like to think of, you know, for example, we do all of ours in oxygen-free packaging, which makes the shelf life about a year. But once you do open them, if there's, you know, a specific amount of time you want to drink them within, which is about 6 weeks to 2 months. So, you know, looking for specifically where they come from, any, you know, stylistic or regional information you can get, making sure it's packaged and date stamped. Those are all very, very good signs. If you don't see those, you know, one of the things I try and tell people to avoid is if you go to a tea shop and they keep opening a big, you know, jar or kind of, you know, drum and dishing out the tea individually with a spoon, that's a bad thing for Japanese tea because that means those teas are continuously being, you know, exposed to air. And that's something that will over time certainly reduce the flavor and aroma of the tea.
Right. I'm curious though, once I open, you know, really good packaged products like yours, shall I refrigerate it or put it in the freezer or keep it on room temperature?
Good question. So if you order a pack of tea from Japan or from us and you get it, and let's say you order three, right? And you're like, well, I only drink one at a time. So I would take the two unopened ones, immediately just put them into the refrigerator, and keeping them at that cool temperature away from light, heat, and moisture will extend the life, you know, keep them in good shape. Once you open it, it really is dependent on how quickly you're going to drink it. So if you're drinking one cup of tea a day, let's say you get a 100-gram pack of tea, which is a typical serving for Japanese tea. It's about 3.5 ounces. You're drinking probably like once a day. Let's say you're drinking, you know, 5 to 6 grams a day. You can kind of start to do the math on how long that's going to last you. If you're taking longer than a month to consume it, what I would suggest doing is probably pouring out half into something to store it out of the fridge, and then keeping that second half of the bag tightly sealed and put that back in the refrigerator. You don't necessarily want to keep moving it in and out of the fridge all the time because you can develop condensation, which over time can be detrimental to the quality. So that's a little bit of a convoluted answer. But what I would say is if you're drinking it within a month, you don't need to keep it in the fridge. If you're taking longer than a month to drink one pack, I would divvy it up, keep some out of the fridge and some in the fridge.
So no freezer.
Yeah, freezers, you know, unless there's very specific reasoning, we don't usually suggest the freezer. If you're going to like store certain matcha for very long periods of time, it's fine. But to be honest, the refrigerator is adequate. You don't typically need to go much cooler than a refrigerator.
Good to know. Okay. And all right, so for our listeners who are not familiar with Japanese tea yet, what is your advice on how to pick the right tea out of many different types for their preference?
Yeah, great. That's a good question. So I think if you've never had Japanese tea before and you kind of want to understand sort of right away sort of the, you know, the real foundational flavor, I would certainly try Sencha to begin with. I think one of the reasons I suggest Sencha as a starting point too is of the styles of Japanese tea, Sencha is produced in the most places. So you have the opportunity to try something, for example, from Shizuoka or from Saitama or, you know, Kyoto. There's many different regions and they're all quite different. So you can kind of explore, and there's always more to learn because there's always different areas you can try the Sencha from. So I think that's a great place to start. Those teas are going to be, you know, grassy. They're going to have some sweetness, some umami, sort of that savory character. And they give you sort of, I think, a really nice, pleasant energy. They are caffeinated. And depending how you brew them, they can be on the lighter side. They can be, you know, definitely more rich and robust. So I think that's a great place to start if you've never had it. Now, if caffeine, for example, is an issue and you think, oh, I don't drink tea because I'm really sensitive to caffeine, you can actually try hojicha. Hojicha is one of my favorite styles of tea. It's a roasted green tea, very aromatic, lots going on with, you know, the fragrance. It's something like kind of enchanting in the sense that it's got something almost coffee-like because it's toasted and roasted. It has this sort of like really beautiful, you know, light, flavor profile on the palate, and because it's roasted and oftentimes some from a later part of the harvest, the caffeine is naturally lower. So that's one that I think is a nice gentle way to start. I'm sure a lot of your listeners and you know, people are familiar with matcha. That's a great tea. It's something that I almost feel like is its own class of teas, because it's, I think a lot of people don't even consider themselves tea drinkers when they drink matcha because it's so sort of, you know, specific in that people have, you know, a real love affair with matcha. So matcha, I think, is great if you're looking for something to replace coffee. So I know a lot of people are saying, oh, I wish I drank less coffee. Not that I have anything against coffee. I think coffee is wonderful, but many people come to us. Even just today, I had someone who said they've sort of substituted coffee with matcha. So I think that's a great place to start if you're looking for that sort of like, you know, energy kick, and also something that can be made quickly and easily, because matcha is the original instant tea. You don't need a teapot. You can just a few little tools and you can make it pretty quickly in the morning.
But it looks like instant tea. It's just a powder. But
yeah, right. I know.
Yeah. But I think, you know, if you have the chest and the whisk, and like going back to the point of very meditative calming moment to make tea, matcha's whisk, whisking matcha to make it the perfect floss, it's a very, very good moment. And it's very positive. You have a moment to think, calm down. And I think that I heard these are the time to come up with new ideas rather than just try to think and just nothing moment. So yeah, I think it's a
good
time.
Yeah, there's one of our producers talks a lot about that, who's a matcha producer in this small area called Uji, which is just south of Kyoto. And he and his wife have, obviously they drink a lot of matcha because they're farmers, but they really talk about spending that time in the morning to just, you know, not have anything to do other than to just enjoy the process. And that's something that, especially here in New York, I think we often take for, you know, we miss that in our busy lives. We have things to do, we have places to go and people to meet, but you know, I get up in the morning and I eat a little something, and then the first thing I do is make tea. And it really is almost like it pulls me into this moment that I feel settled. I feel like I can collect my thoughts for the day. It's not like I have to be there with a strong purpose of like, I got to do this, I got to think about this, I got to come up with an idea. It's just kind of allowing the day to start. And it's something I honestly look forward to every morning when I wake up, and it sets a nice tone for the day. And it's just, you know, a really beautiful time to kind of sit with the tea, enjoy it, and then, you know, prepare myself for the day ahead.
Right. So that's the evacuated and no crazy thoughts. That's back to who you are. So that's the moment of making tea, right? Okay. And by the way, I was going to say, so hojicha, you mentioned much less caffeinated tea. You know, my father, he's from Kyushu, but, you know, he grew up in Tokyo and he had hojicha all the time for some reason. Mm-hmm. And the hojicha in Yame, like, you know, where your office is based, it was so much different. I was surprised. It's a way different, kind of like more gentle, feminine style of tea. Mm-hmm. And I was impressed how regionally the tea, the same category of tea can be different. Like you said earlier, like Sayama tea in Saitama to Kyoto to Shizuoka. So yeah, it's fascinating. So anyways, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on that point of it being, you know, in so many ways similar. I kind of probably sound like a broken record talking about wine, but, you know, it's something that I think we're moving from this idea of tea, like it's Japanese tea and it's all from Japan and it's all similar to, it's really regionally specific. And I think, you know, it's fun to get to share that, especially for people who are familiar. If you've grown up drinking, you know, tea in one place in Japan, you're, you know, that's, to you, that's kind of what you think of as hojicha. And then to try a different version, it can be very surprising and very, I think, enjoyable to be like, wow, I didn't know tea could taste like that, even if you're from the place where it comes from.
Right. Okay. And here's an interesting thing. So you can fully enjoy Japanese tea on its own, like first thing in the morning, like you said, or, you know, all day long. But you have done something interesting, which is food and Japanese tea pairings in the past. So could you share your experiences?
Yeah, this is something I'm really passionate about because I think, you know, it kind of reintroduces people to tea. Tea is something that I always say, like, if you knock on 10 doors in any neighborhood in America and say, I need a cup of tea, do you have any tea? Most of the people are going to say, yeah, hold on a second, I have tea. Meaning that most people are familiar with tea. And that's a really interesting thing because it's not like we're introducing, you know, a kettle, a product that no one's ever heard of. So we're actually dealing with something very familiar, but it's actually quite different than what people probably have experienced drinking tea. It's like, it's so close to, you know, tea is so close to people sometimes that they can't really see it. You know, it's like thinking about like a staple food, like milk or, you know, things that you're just so familiar with and then trying something that's so uniquely different. It really sets people down the path of, I think, being very excited by it and wanting to explore more. So for us, tea pairings are a way to kind of recontextualize the experience of drinking tea. And in the same way you can, you know, pair pretty much any beverage with food, you kind of, you know, we really enjoy kind of finding things that both, you know, complement and contrast the food. And that could mean temperature. So, you know, we serve hot teas with food, cold teas with food. We carbonate teas and try them in a wine glass. And it's just a really, I think, fun way to explore the full range of expression that Japanese tea gives us. And it's, you know, obviously a great way for us to interact with a lot of our partners, our wholesale partners, with chefs, with restaurants. And I know, Akiko, you're familiar with this because you wrote a wonderful article in Forbes about it. But, you know, in restaurants now, sometimes 30, 40, even 50% of guests are not drinking alcohol. And, you know, that's something that I think has sort of opened the, you know, avenue to use tea as a way to get people involved with beverage in restaurants. So, you know, one of the reasons we love serving tea in wine glasses, I talk about this all the time, is that, you know, if you're out to dinner and you decide you don't want to have alcohol, but everyone else is drinking wine and you have a hot teacup and they all have a wine glass, it immediately sort of positions you as an outsider at the meal. And putting it into a wine glass is a way to sort of make, you know, everyone feel inclusive. And it's so funny because dining is so much about mirroring. It's about the way you hold the wine glass. It's about the way you cheers, you know, the way you can swirl it and look at it. And, you know, you can participate in the meal the same way as people who are drinking. And it's the same. We do these tea cocktails, which have no alcohol in them. they come in a rocks glass with a beautiful piece of ice. And, you know, the tactile experience is exactly the same, but you don't need to consume alcohol because tea has so much, you know, so many unique flavor profiles. And, you know, it just adds so much. You know, it's not just like having a sparkling water. It actually provides kind of a real culinary experience. So that's something that I'm really passionate about. And we've been doing them in the past, and we have, you know, more events planned for the future as well.
Right. It's surprising. I think the tea has good umami, which is always a bridging point with food. So it's not just Japanese food, but, you know, you've done a lot of interesting Western style food and Japanese tea pairings very successfully. Just to add one more point of, you know, the glass, wine glass and Japanese tea. I think by served in wine glass, just like Japanese sake, tea gets better opportunity to show off its flavors. So it's kind of win-win to be not just how it looks, but Japanese teas in glass instead of, you know, like a very old style, classic style, beautiful cup. I think transparency, it really is the Japanese green tea color. It's stunning, like really beautiful. Mm. So yeah, it's like the win-win. I think the idea of, you know, served in Western style table, I think it's a part of the future of Japanese tea. So,
mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. And so also Japanese is becoming increasingly popular these days. And in 2021, the export value of tea from Japan doubling, that is in 2015, which is a lot of increase. And the top destination was the US, which accounted for 50%, the half of the total. So it means that now premium Japanese tea is more widely available outside of Japan. So who actually is drinking Japanese tea outside of Japan, and where are they drinking? At home or restaurant or cafes, or where are they?
That is a great question and information we are always trying to study and understand, because like you said, there's been a rapid development of tea consumption increasing outside of Japan. And you do see it in the United States, you see it in parts of Western Europe, but you do really even see it globally. And I think that, you know, it's a lot of people, everyone's drinking it. I mean, here in New York City, if you look at on a Saturday afternoon in our cafes, I mean, we have people from every borough here, you know, male, female, and it's just something that I think it's growing in popularity. And I think the reason why is the, you know, the world is a lot smaller now with access to, you know, items from every, you know, every country imaginable. So tea is no different. I mean, people can now come in New York City to a place and try teas from, you know, 12 prefectures. And, you know, each year more and more people are able to kind of interface with these products. And I think it's a testament to how, you know, unique and delicious tea is that the people who try it more often than not want to have that experience again. So I often feel like people do go out and have some of their first experiences around Japanese tea in, you know, whether it's in a restaurant or at a cafe that's focused on tea. And then the nice thing about it is it becomes a ritual that people take home. And it's something that they can start their day with, or in the afternoon, or even in the evening. It's something that's repeated daily. So we actually have seen since the pandemic was a huge growth period for us because so many people were at home and were discovering like, oh my gosh, this is something I did never really pay attention to before. But, you know, they were getting a teapot, they were getting loose tea leaves, or they were buying a matcha whisk, you know, cha sen with the powder. And they started to create these rituals at home that, you know, now they're like, oh, I honestly, we get people every day that come in and say, oh, you know, this is something I look forward to and do every day. And it's a daily ritual. So I do feel like restaurants now are, you know, the expectations from customers are much higher than they used to be. So, you know, especially in, you know, nice restaurants, like, you know, they're sourcing their tomatoes and their rice and their, you know, the meat from all of these great producers. And then, you know, at the end of the meal, they were bringing out tea bags. And I think customers were like, hey, you know, if you care about all these other products, why are you kind of phoning it in on the tea program? And that's changed a lot. That demand has really, you know, changed. And I think restaurateurs are paying attention. And that also is a cycle. Then people come in, they try the teas. And we get people all the time that come in and say, oh my God, I had your tea at, you know, such and such a restaurant. I loved it. I want to buy some. And they become, you know, they become customers kind of through that entry point.
Right. So it started to be there's a good cycle, learning and actually available. You try it and it's a part of your life and it's a very ideal pattern.
I think you nailed it. Yeah. I was just going to say, with anything, education is and exposure is so important. And that's why we really care about having physical locations in addition to our online site, because it's so different to go in and to experience it and to get the support you need and like how it's brewed. And people want to ask questions. You know, it's not like you can open a bottle and pour it out the way you can with other beverages. You really need to participate in it. So for us, I think you nailed it when you said that education element and that experience element is so important. But as I always say, once people try it, it, you know, especially because, oh, I've had tea, I'm familiar with tea. When you can offer someone who, you know, an experience that reshapes their expectations of a thing that they feel very familiar with, that's a very strong customer experience. So that's something we love watching, is the first time someone tries Gyokuro or the first time someone has fresh roasted hojicha, and then their eyes light up and they're like, oh man, like I can never un-experience that. Like now I want that. And that's exactly what happened to me when we talked about in the beginning, my traveling to Japan. You know, the first time, I didn't mention it in this episode, but, you know, I was introduced to a very specific tea that changed my, you know, perception of what tea could taste like. And that actually made me go to Japan to kind of seek that experience, because at that time, it wasn't, you know, there weren't so many places you could experience tea like that. And now that's something I really try to, you know, to share as an experience with our customers, is that, you know, we have, and other purveyors as well, have teas that people have never experienced before. But once they do, it really changes their perception of what tea can taste like.
Interesting. Right. First time you really get obsessed with, like, I have to try that again. That kind of strong taste memory, I think it's really an enriched experience of your whole life, right? Like, if you could eat the same thing every day, but once you have it and it's something to look forward to, and a tea is very easy to drink every day. And it's not like super expensive, like thank you, $1,500 bottle of wine or anything. So that's amazing. And also, you know, by the way, before the show, we just chat that specific tea you got fell in love with. And recently I tasted the same thing. And I was like, why is it so delicious? It's a Sencha, and I had that Sencha category many, many times. So this is something different. And I don't know why. And you didn't even know why yet. So that's a magic.
Mysterious thing. There's certain things we can, you know, we can describe and explain. And then there's, you know, even the producers, you talk to them, sometimes they'll say, yeah, I'm not really sure. It's just, that's, it's a confluence of the, you know, the land and the weather and the seasonality and the production style. It's very complex.
Right. So that's the nature's gift in a way.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. So, but despite such a special tradition, you know, and its popularity abroad increasingly, the Japanese tea industry has been declining. So why is that?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, like anything, tea in Japan has struggled to sort of find its home as, you know, people are moving to the city, people are looking for convenience. So I think, you know, it has been declining within Japan as people just look for, you know, a lot of more people drinking coffee. And then even in coffee, they're drinking, you know, convenient things they can buy at the convenience store or in a vending machine. But it's funny because people still drink a lot of bottled tea. So there is a tradition. It's just moved into this sort of like convenience focused version of tea. Where I have a suspicion, to be honest, that tea will start to rebound because it's, you know, gaining popularity abroad. We're seeing more actually in the last couple of years, more tea cafes opening within Japan. And I think that will lead to generationally a younger generation becoming more interested in it. But I do also feel to that point that, you know, the outside of Japan, the market that exists outside of Japan is very much the future of Japanese tea in terms of giving a wider audience to the producers. Because even in Japan, honestly, and you can tell me if you agree with this, a lot of people who drink tea, you know, in Japan are not necessarily even sure where it comes from. They say, oh, it's sencha. Yeah. Oh, is it from, oh, Shizuoka? I actually don't know. So that level of seeing it as kind of an artisanal beverage is very different there than it is abroad. And I think I've seen the farmers kind of change their mind about, like, oh, in the beginning when I first started sourcing, there was a real reluctance to ship the teas out because they thought, well, I don't know, are people going to understand how to make it? Like, the, you know, it's difficult. Like, you know, the exchange of, you know, it's the cultures, it's too big of a gap. It's not going to work. And I think they've really started to change their minds, seeing that the deep appreciation for the artisanal kind of characteristics of Japanese tea abroad. So I think that ultimately, though, as many things do, they leave Japan, they sort of get influenced outside of Japan, and then they sort of find their way back to Japan in a way. And then it's something funny. It's like, you know, it happens in the United States too, like where somebody in another culture shines a light on something that you just didn't notice before. And it kind of gives you this sort of like pride and also sort of this like permission to be like, wow, that is special. We do a really good job at that. And it sort of promotes from that perspective, you know, people within Japan wanting to enjoy it as well. So that's my hope, is that us making tea more sort of accessible and more popular here in the United States will ultimately drive the market in Japan as well.
Interesting. Yeah. And, you know, by the way, that patterns of people, Japanese people, I think I had this conversation with the past guests too. So we need to be more confident as Japanese. And then other people say, like, whoa, really? Is this so valuable? So, oh, maybe you can be more confident. That's like a classic pattern of everything almost, you know, Japanese sake to any, like a shochu. The traditional value, people think, well, it's a tiny little island country. People don't understand. Mm-hmm. It's too complicated. But I think the objective analytical view of what exactly it is, people don't, like you said, I totally agree. When I grew up, I drinking tea every day, but I really didn't think of even Shizuoka, like, what's Shizuoka? What's the difference from Kyoto tea? I really didn't think of it. And it's just like a water, keep drinking, and your parents drinking it. Right. I drink the same thing. And I, to be honest, because my dad was drinking hojicha, I thought hojicha was the tea, not sencha.
Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting. And I'm so glad to hear there's a rebounding movement, and also like maybe like coffee, the third wave coffee, everybody started being more artisanal and handmade drip coffee. And it's really valuable, not just the taste, but the ritual of time and focus and the quality. So hopefully, based on what you said, the third wave style of tea may arrive in Japan sometime, hopefully soon. Yeah, so how do you envision the future of Japanese tea, not just Japanese consumer market, but also overall globally?
Yeah, I mean, whether I envision it this way or not, it's growing. So I have to, you know, we have to accept that it is a product that's growing abroad. And I think that we're still sort of in this infancy, which is a really special place to be because, you know, people who are participating both within Japan and outside of Japan still have a lot of influence over the direction it goes. And ultimately, you know, myself and, you know, the folks that work with me here at Kettle, we've decided, you know, we have a very specific way we want things to progress. And that's really championing the grower, and it's championing people. You know, it's not just, I think people a lot of times think, often, you know, tea is a thing, it's a product, it's a commodity, but it's actually, if you, you know, it's there's so much more than that. And I think that for us, the thread runs back to the producer. So we do take a very artisanal look at it. It doesn't necessarily mean we want things to be overly expensive or, you know, everything's written with super flowery language. It's not. It's about understanding that the products are works of art. I mean, they're, you know, a farmer has only limited amount of times in their life they get to produce that first harvest of tea. So it's something very, very special. And we really want to focus on creating a marketplace that supports them. We want to create an industry of professionals where we can all speak the same language. We can all agree on, you know, what the standards of quality are, that the customers understand how to shop for, you know, products, how to understand labeling, how to understand, you know, what is predatory marketing in terms of, you know, statements about health versus what's the truth. I mean, it's for me, it's like the incredibly exciting time to be a part of this because, you know, our decisions now will shape the future of it. So I see it in a lot of ways developing like wine. I think that there'll be, you know, there's always going to be different levels of quality and people want to spend different amounts. So there'll be options for people who, you know, want to get something, you know, less expensive that they drink high volumes of. I think there's going to be the opposite. There's, you know, we're already seeing very small amounts of very, very, very high quality tea coming in that certain customers are looking for. And I think, you know, there's so much. Like tonight after this, I have, you know, two calls with farmers in Japan to talk about, you know, this season, about what we expect, about forecasts and about how they're feeling about it. And that dialogue to me is something that is really important because it's not just us to say, you know, in the States saying, here's the future of Japanese tea. We want to participate in it with the farmers and with the producers and kind of map out together, you know, what we want to happen. And it's a really exciting time for everybody. So it's something I think, you know, we get up every morning, go to work, my wife and I, and we talk about it in the car on the way to work about how exciting it is to be a part of this industry now, because I think things are starting to rapidly develop. And I think people will be very surprised that the customers and the folks who are, you know, being introduced to these teas, how quickly they're going to demand quality and how quickly they're going to demand access to, you know, to better products. So that's something I think for me, that's my hope for the future.
Right. Well, I think you are one of the strong forces to, you know, promote this whole movement of education and understanding and also actually bridging in delivering super high quality tea. And I know your products and I can see your farmers, like, you know, listeners can see on the website, they're really real people, craftsmen, and their whole life is just making good tea. And that's really, by itself, is beautiful. So yeah, I appreciate more by seeing the farmer's actual face and what they're doing.
To your point too, I think you were talking about it earlier about how tea is declining in Japan. And it's so funny because in spite of that, you know, farmers and producers in the industry are actually trying harder to produce quality, which is, you'd think, the opposite, where people would say like, oh, what's the point? There's less people drinking it in Japan, so let's take shortcuts. And it's like, there's never been more very high quality tea being produced in Japan, in spite of the fact that the industry has declined. And that passion is what really excites me. And that's why I think it's important to create a market, because those products are being made at such a high level that I feel like my responsibility is to say, okay, let's find people and connect those people to these products, because I know how hard they're working and I know how difficult it must be, you know, to be insecure about what the future of your domestic marketplace looks like. So I think you kind of wove that thread together for me there. That was a really, I think, really good point.
Right. And also, as we talked earlier, you know, Japanese people feel more assured of the value of what they're making. So now the market, like Japanese sake or shochu, more value-added products are becoming more famous and in the market, more demanded in the market globally. That really motivates those craftsmen in Japan. And it's a good movement. So yeah, I really think that, you know, the way you actually introduced your book, your tea, of course, shops, everything is very important to support these traditional farmers. I don't know how many generations some of them are. So they're like whole family business for centuries. Mm-hmm. And we don't think we should stop there. So it's important.
Very true.
Right. So, by the way, you know, we talk about sustainability, about everything nowadays. So how important is sustainability in terms of Japanese tea? Because it's a, you know, at the end of the day, it's an agricultural product.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Great question. I think sustainability and a focus on, you know, being a stewardship of the land is something that, you know, is incredibly important for any agricultural product, right? But tea, you know, specifically as well. So, you know, the farmers we work with, we spend a lot of time, you know, trying to understand the methodology of how they produce. And I can say that, you know, I think producers in Japan have a keen respect and a keen sort of eye for, you know, understanding the natural world and understanding nature and trying to work with the rhythms of nature. And, you know, as you know better than anyone, you know, nature is a strong theme and a very influential part of Japanese culture is that relationship to nature. And it's something that sensitivity that I find really inspiring in Japan. It doesn't mean every single farm or every single farmer in Japan, you know, is doing all the right things, but I think that there is a strong understanding that, you know, using more natural methods to produce tea will be most beneficial. And one of the reasons why is, you know, having to move these products out of Japan into places like the EU or the United States, where there are specifically strict, you know, laws about pesticides, about, you know, heavy metals, about radioactive material, like that's something that farmers are very sensitive to. And, you know, one of the things I feel so lucky about is the commitment to sort of stewardship of the land and quality and safety that is, you know, the steps that are followed in Japan are very high in regards to those, you know, things I just mentioned. So it is something that needs to be considered. It needs, you know, there are still methods being developed now in terms of fertilizers and, you know, Japan is really, I think, at the forefront of, you know, the tea industry being able to create clonals or, you know, cultivars of the tea plant in order to, you know, to have the best outcomes, meaning that they're more frost resistant or they're going to, you know, be able to live in a hotter climate like in Kyushu. So there's a lot of actual science going on behind the scenes in Japan to make sure that teas are being produced at a high level with a lot of flavor and quality, but also, you know, that are going to have the least impact on the earth. So that's something I think we can always get better at and something we, I think farmers as well as us here at Kettle are always kind of talking about each year as well.
Right. And also sustainably operating as a business and also, you know, healthy, physically healthy, there's pesticides, all those things. So we'll see what's going to happen hopefully near future. It's going to be really sustainable, really famous business as sustainable.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're on the right path. And I think, you know, like for us, we have all of our teas third party tested. So obviously we, you know, we want to make sure that they're safe. And I can say, you know, I don't work in any other origins, but I think, Japanese farmers really take this stuff quite serious and they know, you know, that acting responsibly is the right move, even if sometimes it's more expensive or they're not able to produce the same volume. I think generally it's sort of understood in Japan that's the right way to go.
Right. Okay. So what are your plans and dreams in the short term and long term? Because it sounds like you have a lot going on.
That's a good question. I mean, I sometimes have to kind of collect my thoughts because we have so much we want to do. But I think, you know, this year we're really focused on a lot of education. So we're building out, you know, we're now programming 5 classes a week here in New York where people can come in and learn about tea and experience it. We have more programming in our stores. we're opening up our gallery space. We have a cafe now, as you mentioned, in Brooklyn, where you can do kind of like easy to go tea. You can sit at our counter and do a tasting. We're opening this month a new traditional tea service with Wagashi, which is a traditional tea suite. And that'll be a little bit more introspective, quiet, seated tea experience. We're actually now working on our third location in Los Angeles, which is underway right now, hoping to open later this year. So, you know, California is our second largest market. So we're trying to, you know, number one, you know, grow our brand there and grow Japanese tea consumption on the West Coast, but also kind of to your point of sustainability, we're building an operation there so we can not have to fly or ship the teas over California in order to ship them back. We're actually going to start warehousing things and distributing from the West Coast in order to, you know, be more, you know, conscious of the environment by, you know, making our footprint smaller. And then, yeah, we have a lot of interesting, you know, sourcing this year. My wife and I are heading to Japan the beginning of next month to do, you know, our first big sourcing trip since the pandemic. So, you know, I just want to, again, connect more growers, tell their story more. I'm working on a book, my second book, which will be focused on matcha, and will be going from A to Z, from all points, you know, from how it's cultivated, the history of it, you know, how it's produced in the factories, who's making it, how to buy it, how to prepare it, all the fun things you can do with it. And it'll be very rich in photos. And then there'll actually be some video content that'll live online as well. So I don't know. I get too excited thinking about the future. So there's a lot of work to do. And we're just excited to get to showcase all these beautiful products from all the great producers we work with.
Right, amazing. So I think sounds like you have to come back here soon and give us all the updates.
We'll be back next. Let's do it next week. We'll just get, you know, we'll have some updates. No, maybe that's too soon.
Right.
Not quite that soon.
Yeah, well, we couldn't even finish the whole questions. We have so many, but yeah, we can just like every month series if you want to.
Okay, I'm in.
So you have so much to offer.
Sorry, I also talk a lot, so.
No, it's a, you know, it's so much, and it's just so many multi aspects that, you know, you can look at not just tea, but through the lens of tea. There's so many issues we want to discuss. And also, like, I think going back to the point, tea is, it's a beverage, but it's the moment it becomes who you are. And that's the starting point of drinking Japanese tea. Yeah. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
Yeah, so we are active primarily on Instagram, and our handle is the @kettletea. It's KETTLTEA. And then on our website, which is kettle.co, so KETTL.co, we're pretty active on our blog. We do a lot of updates and our newsletter, which you can sign up for, where we do, you know, new products that are coming in. We even do like this on this trip. I'll be doing a bunch of fun, you know, live streams from the farms. So I'll get to introduce a little bit about harvest, the farmers, how they're working. So, yeah, I think really kettle.co or @kettletea on Instagram is the best place to follow along.
Awesome. Yeah. So the point is no L, no E at the end, right? K-E-T-T-L.
Right.
Right.
Right. All right. Exactly.
So, well, thank you so much for joining us today. And, well, have a great trip in Japan and come back and we'll discuss a lot more about amazing world of tea.
Well, thank you so much for always including me in the show. It's an honor always to be on and I appreciate it so much. Thanks for all your great questions.
Okay, thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@theheritageradionetwork.org or kikotema.com. Japan Needs is a weekly program and is always available at theheritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Amen Spenjan, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.